Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff, in studio with Peter Phillips. Today, we'll kick things off with Dr. Paul Palmer talking about getting to zero waste, universal recycling as a practical alternative to endless attempts to clean up pollution. In the second part of the program today, we'll speak with Sansara Taylor, journalist with Revolution Newspaper, who is also founder of StopPatriarchy.org. We'll be talking to Sansara about women's rights, censorship, and possibilities for real revolutionary change. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm Mickey Huff in studio with Peter Phillips. In this segment, we are going to talk about getting to zero waste. Our guest is Dr. Paul Palmer. Palmer received his PhD in physical chemistry from Yale University in 1966, taught chemistry in Europe and other parts of the world. In 1973, Palmer founded Zero Waste Systems Incorporated in Berkeley, California, and soon thereafter it moved to Oakland, California. And about 7 years ago, Paul Palmer published this book. It's called Getting to Zero Waste, Universal Recycling as a Practical Alternative to Endless Attempts to Clean Up Pollution. Paul Palmer joins us in studio. Welcome.
Thank you.
Paul, tell us the main point of your book, I think, and what do you mean by zero waste?
Yeah, that's good. I like to get to the positive aspect because it's so easy to dwell on the negative. What I mean by zero waste is a theory of the use of resources, the rational, intelligent, scientific theory of how do we use resources. Right now we have multiple trillions of dollars worth of resources being used every week, every month. Who adds them up? I don't know what it really is, but it's fabulously huge. When you think of water and plant material and metals and ores and petroleum, that all which comes from nature and we just consume it, we gobble it up. The closest we come to a theory is what Wendell Berry says, the biggest pump wins. Whoever gets to consume and use up the most fastest is the guy who has the rights to do it. And that's all backed up in law. There is no resource policy in this country. It's free-willing, free enterprise, free market. That's the way it works.
To a certain extent, isn't the idea of recycling really kind of to make garbage more acceptable than to continue to support waste management companies' profit-taking under our capitalist system?
Well, before I quite get to recycling, let me finish the thought on what zero waste really is.
Okay.
So I said it was a rational scientific theory. And what I want to point out is that it's a theory of how to reuse everything, because basically there is no other alternative than reusing things as a way to avoid somehow discarding them, putting them out into the environment. So you have to have reuse constantly turning over cycles, agricultural cycles, plastic cycles, chemical cycles. Everything has to be part of a cycle. And what I've tried to do is put out on my website, actual practical expositions, examples of how you do that, how you set that up. Once you accept that that's needed, it turns out to be quite accessible. Fairly, I don't know if I want to call it easy, but I find it easy to think about these things. How would you do this rationally instead of trying to find a way to throw something away and then destroy it? And that now we can get to recycling, because recycling was a response to a perceived emergency back around the late 60s, when all the garbage companies were consolidating, all of the mom and pops were being bought up, and they became super mega garbage companies and super mega dumps. And then the EPA got into it and started legislating enforced discard. I know people may not like that, but that's what they do. They legislate garbage. They force. That's what regulations are for. As a friend, Jane Ann Morris, says, the purpose of environmental regulation is to regulate the environmentalists. And I think that encapsulates it. So environmentalists, who were very well-intentioned at the time, were desperately looking for a solution. They said, well, there's all this garbage coming. It's sweeping us. It's coming in torrents. Let's do something with it. So they try to investigate the composition and find what was in it and what they could use. And they came up with the idea, well, let's try to reuse the materials. That was fine for the 60s. That was a positive, progressive impulse. But now we're 40, 50 years later. It's no longer a progressive impulse. Now, what has happened is the garbage industry realized this was the greatest thing that has ever come along for them, because recycling in the public mind now makes it okay to create all the garbage you want. Go ahead, throw everything out, design everything for obsolescence. We're going to recycle it. It's all okay. Don't worry about it. And so people have gotten this notion that recycling somehow takes care of things. It's opposed to garbage. But what you have to understand, what people need to understand, is recycling is a form of garbage management. And that really is the key. Garbage management. That's what recycling is. It's not against garbage, but it's for garbage. How do you make garbage more acceptable after it's created?
This is amazing kind of garbage industry propaganda, really, to kind of, again, to justify and rationalize a disposable culture.
That's exactly right. The garbage industry just loves recycling. The greatest, the biggest recycling company, I think, in the country is called Recycle America. It's run by Waste Management. Well, Waste Management has a pretty nasty history and reputation, and it's very well deserved. They spend hundreds of millions of dollars in fines, and it's just the cost of doing business for them. And they would not support anything that threatened their business. You can be absolutely sure of that.
Well, Paul Palmer, getting to zero waste, that certainly wouldn't be on the waste management agenda.
No, absolutely not. The recycling community and the recycling mentality is designed to increase garbage. The more recycling goes on, the less reuse that there actually is. So if we get a chance, I want to talk about the two basic principles that underlie the theory of recycling. Not that there is a theory. No one publishes any theory or calls it any theory. But the concept of recycling is based on two principles. We can get into that.
Well, you've started that. So tell us the two principles.
And okay. All right. Well, the first principle is that there always has been and there always will be garbage. You can't stop it. You can't do anything better than that. Garbage is going to come at us in waves, in rivers, and we have to do something with it. So anything we do is positive. Now, there's no rational basis for that belief. We've been acting that way for 50,000 years, but we started out throwing meat scraps and bones out the cave door. That was simple. That worked. You know, it was just organic matter. And now we've got 5 million synthetic chemicals, and we've got 50,000 different plastics, and we've got medical estrogen mimics, and I don't know what. You know, we have nasty stuff, and the idea that you can throw it out of the cave door is idiotic. So, but there is no alternative to just throwing it out the cave door. People still talk. It's amazing, but they still talk about manufacturing capacity being limited by the ability of nature to process our wastes. Idiotic. There's no basis for that whatsoever. What we have to do is start designing for reuse. Use our scientific expertise.
Now, we're speaking with Dr. Paul Palmer, Getting to Zero Waste. This is the Project Censored Show on Pacific Radio. I'm Mickey Huff in studio with Peter Phillips. Paul Palmer, you just said reuse. Let's go back to this issue again. When we talk about recycle as opposed to reuse, I remember several years ago the well-known documentarian Michael Moore made a quip about how he doesn't recycle, or recycling doesn't work, or it all goes to the dump anyway. And he came under a lot of fire and pressure for that, certainly by liberal groups. However, could you expand upon that? What he was saying isn't exactly inaccurate.
No, Michael Moore was right on the mark. In fact, I quote him in the book where I talk about how opposition to recycling has been growing. One of the problems that's been coming along is what I call the personal delusion. People think that they are responsible, that their little garbage can is what is creating this torrent of garbage. But that is not even close to being true. So we have the personal delusion really playing itself out, especially now locally in San Francisco, where they have this huge program, this campaign to, as they like to call it, zero waste to landfill. Well, a landfill is just a dump, and what they want to do is just recycle, which means crushing things up and destroying them and using a few materials. But they try to bring it down to the personal level. They have these garbage cans and dumpsters, and they're going to break them up and tear them up. We call it eat and treat sometimes. And what they have to realize is that a whole society does not revolve around what individuals use. The usual estimate in this field is that industry creates 70 times as much garbage as individuals do. That came out of a recycling center in Boulder, and it's widely used now. Anyway, so if you take that as a given, that there's 70 times as much garbage from industry, well, that the reason that garbage is being produced is ultimately to produce the products that are being used by society. So it is the part of the basis of creating those products. And it's just as important to think about that as it is to think about what comes out of a personal garbage can. So if you think about it that way and take San Francisco's much vaunted 80% recycling rate, as though that were significant anyway. But anyway, if you add in the industrial waste that's being produced in order to produce those products, then San Francisco is dealing with maybe 2% of everything that's out there. And then if you add in all the buildings and all the roads and all of the infrastructure that is purposely made just to be destroyed at the end of its life. It's not made to be reused. It's not modularized. It's not standardized. And that ends up being crushed up and put into dumps or being used for some very low-level application, just as gravel in the best case. Then probably you could say that San Francisco is accomplishing 1% reuse value would be realistic.
Well, Paul Palmer, you talked about the idea that we're really not understanding what recycle means, and it's not zero, that we're really creating mountains of garbage. Companies make profits off of that garbage, and we have a system of capitalism where we're producing things that people acquire and then use up and discard, and that creates that garbage. And you're saying that we could have a system, it could still be capital-based, but be creating products that can be completely used or sustained and could be reused. They could last a long time. You can fill up your containers on a regular basis and not have to recreate new ones. And you also talk about this study that Robert Krauss had done from New Zealand, where he surveyed waste companies all over the world. What happened with his research?
Well, Robert has been working on that for about 3 or 4 years. He started out by thinking he was going to do a study of what they call zero waste to landfill. I think I mentioned that. The word landfill is interesting in itself because it was created in the 60s or 70s because they didn't like the word dump, because dump is too Anglo-Saxon, too raw, too fresh. So landfill makes everything sound fragrant. And as I say, I've never seen any land that was just waiting to be filled up with garbage. So even the terminology is a fraud. But what Robert found was that there were these programs all around the world, certainly all around the United States, that were designed to what they called zero waste. They applied the term zero waste, but all that they meant was let's recycle everything. Let's smash everything up and let's just get a little bit of glass, let's get a little steel, let's get a little bit of copper, and we'll throw away all the rest. Remember now that I did start a company for reusing chemicals, and the recyclers have no idea what that's about. Recyclers tend to be not too technically advanced, and what everyone used to say about chemicals was just dispose of properly, which is a crazy oxymoron. And so we found that these chemicals were among the most easily reused of the commodities. But going back to Robert's work, he found that his best efforts could not locate a successful program. He looked around at the world's zero waste to landfill programs, and he discovered every one of them was a failure on its own terms. They said they were going to achieve 100% or 90% diversion rates, and not one of them did. And so he changed his focus from what's going on in the world for zero waste to landfill to why are they all failing? And then he recently published his thesis. And one of the case studies that he did was San Francisco. He did Toronto and a few others, and one was San Francisco. And Robert thinks that he sees that the officials in San Francisco, even as we speak today, are preparing their exits because they know it's going to fail. And the purpose of it is not to avoid garbage creation. As I said, recycling is not even intended for that. But the purpose of it is to make it okay for garbage companies to post their profits for 10 more years. And after that, they'll figure out how to continue dumping and destroying the resources of the planet for 10 more years. And that's the real purpose that it serves.
So that seems like a delay of really making cultural transformations in terms of production, where we make products that can be sustaining, reused, and are designed not to ever be thrown away.
Right. I have a number of proposals that I put in on my website, which is the zerowasteinstitute.org, under projects. And there's probably 30 different projects that I discuss how to build reuse into different products, and also how to change the processes, the social processes, the consumer processes by which they're used. You can't simply tweak a product and expect that you're suddenly going to be able to reuse it or have a zero waste system. So one of them that I've been pretty interested in is fence posts. Now, that may not sound very sexy, but if you go out on a typical urban street corner and look at all the posts that there are, the signs, the fences, the lampposts, et cetera. I was on one, and I counted 32 posts that were in the ground that had to be supported. Well, all of those are done the same way. It's exactly the same way that your father did it and your grandfather and your great-grandfather. Nothing has changed since the Romans. They invented concrete. You dig a big hole in the ground, and you fill it full of concrete, and you stick a post in it. And what happens at the end of that life, remember, we're talking about cycles now. So end of life is what you want to – end of first life is what you want to be focusing on. At the end of the first life, the post corrodes. It may be wood. It may be steel. It rusts. It rots. You dig this thing up out of the ground. It's a – I call it a concrete lollipop. In this country, we hire a dumpster usually, and we throw it in the dumpster, and it goes into a dump. I have a picture on my website of a bank in Costa Rica that had one of these lollipops on the front lawn and people walking up and down because no one knows what to do with them. And so they represent this gigantic waste. Well, let's say that we try to apply a rational analysis to this. How do we put a post in the ground in such a way that it stands there, it's secure, it doesn't go anywhere, but at the end of its life, for whatever reason, maybe someone just wants to move a fence. At the end of its life, you take it out of the ground, you disassemble it, it has parts, you put it together with a new post in a new place, you store the parts maybe, and you keep reusing these things over and over and over. And so I designed a number of these, I don't have a good name for them, we need a sexy name, but anyway, these fence post stabilizers that you can attach to a post, one near the top of the ground, one near the bottom of the ground, about a couple of feet down below, and they stabilize it. They create a torque couple that keeps the post vertical, and I've used them. I built fences with them, and they work great. But instead, we persist in filling up the ground with concrete lollipops that no one has any use for.
Well, Paul Palmer, when you say, again, getting to zero waste, you're talking about the literal alternative to recycling. But I'm wondering, maybe people in the audience are hearing you say, don't recycle. And getting to zero waste means that you're not recycling. That's pretty clearly what you're saying, right? it's different between reuse. But what do you say to people now, right now, today, in the system we have, where we have these multi-million dollar, billion dollar industries of garbage, of waste, of recycling? What's your advice to tell people to move away from this?
Mostly, I would say move away from the mentality, the concept that you can't ever do anything except perpetuate the waste. That garbage is not cute. There are hundreds of books written about where garbage goes and where it comes from. There are 10,000 studies done by municipalities and all around the country, over and over, studying the composition of garbage. Stop doing this. Stop focusing always on the problem and thinking how great it is, and we're going to make some tiny incremental improvements. We're going to worry about garbage rates and green cans and purple cans. Let's deal with solutions for a change. Let's actually get to solving the problem of how do we create products that can be reused productively, repeatedly, and for the long term. So I would like to see, for example, some real zero waste thought. I hope that some of the people who are listening will want to join with me and build a zero waste institute, build a zero waste research center. There should be research done on how do we redesign products so that they can be reused. I mean, this is not magic. Recycling is just magic. You just sort of reach out and you grab some stuff and you just reuse some materials. It's so low level. But when you want to get scientific about it, you have to do some research and you have to do design. And that's what I hope would someday happen.
So you're saying that not only would we be taking our own bags to the grocery store.
Yes.
But you would also be saying we'd be taking all our containers.
Yes, yes.
To the grocery store.
That's right.
And filling them up as well, in addition to not buying products or buying a car that would ideally last for 25 years and then could be reused in a very real way ad infinitum like they do in Cuba.
Well, it isn't just designing a car that's so robust that it lasts for 25 or 100 years, but it's standardizing, modularizing, putting in repair systems. You have to change the ways in which cars are thought about, the mentality of let's just throw it away and let's crush it up. That's going to take some concentrated work.
We've been speaking with Dr. Paul Palmer, author of Getting to Zero Waste, Universal Recycling as a Practical Alternative to Endless Attempts to Clean Up Pollution. Paul Palmer, thanks so much for joining us today. Could you please give your website one more time?
Yes, it's Zero Waste Institute, one word, .org. And especially look up the principles of zero waste and the projects that I lay out.
Dr. Paul Palmer, thanks so much for joining us on the Project Censored Show. Coming up next on the Project Censored Show, we'll speak with Sansara Taylor of Revolution Newspaper about stopping patriarchy. Please stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff in studio with Peter Phillips. We turn now to Sansara Taylor, who is a writer with Revolution Newspaper. Sansara Taylor is also the founder of StopPatriarchy.org. Sansara joins us by phone.
Hi, nice to be with you.
Sansara, thanks so much for joining us. Could you tell our listeners about StopPatriarchy.org, the full name of this project that started some time ago, and how did it get started, and what is it about?
Yes, I would love to. The full name of the project is End Pornography and Patriarchy, the Enslavement and Degradation of Women. And for understandable reasons, we've shortened for our website down to StopPatriarchy.org, but I encourage people to come and check it out at the website and kind of look around at what we're about. But in short, we are told almost every day in this society, we're bombarded by the message that women have achieved their equality. There's nothing holding young girls back. You can be anything you want to be. Women are out achieving men over here and over there. There's all this being bombarded all the time. And there are significant changes and the position of women as compared to a generation ago and especially longer ago. There's conspicuous changes, women in public life, women in all kinds of different ways. But the cold reality is that one in four women will be raped or sexually assaulted in her life. Every 9 seconds, a woman is beaten. We live in a society that is saturated with the degradation and commodification of women's bodies. I mean, you can't go to a comedy show without hearing women being derided and ridiculed and the butt of jokes. And so we live in a world and in a society where women are told that they have achieved their equality, and yet while there are changes in the conditions of women, the brutality and insult and oppression remains, and it's very disorienting to people. It's very disorienting, and so a lot of young women experience it as an individual problem. And in that sense, we've actually gone backwards. And so Stop Patriarchy, I initiated this. I work with the Revolutionary Communist Party, and there was a certain recognition of the need to take on this increasingly vicious culture towards women. But there was also a need, you know, to unite very broadly with people coming from different perspectives. But there was a need within this to recognize sort of two mirror opposites or seemingly mirror opposite fronts of this war on women. And no one had actually been connecting them up and taking this on as a whole. And the two fronts are, one, just the all-out assault on women's right to abortion and birth control, which is, you know, literally in a state of emergency. 97% of U.S. counties don't have an abortion provider. 5 states in this country have only one clinic in the entire state that does abortion. It's never been more stigmatized. It's never been more dangerous to provide. It's never been more difficult to access. So this is one thing. The whole sort of Christian fascist assault to reduce women to breeders. And then on the other side, you have this sort of mainstreaming of the most violent, degrading, vicious, and cruel, and woman-hating pornography, and the whole culture of sexualized degradation, which is becoming mainstream and normalized and is shaping and forming, you know, young people's, including young men's, view of what sexuality is and should be. And this goes along with and fuels a whole culture of rape and the trafficking of women and the pimping of young girls. And so we are recognizing that between the Pope and the pornographer, between reducing women to breeders or reducing them to sex objects, there's no fundamental difference. Both of them strip women of their humanity, and we are fighting against all forms of degradation against women. And that's where, you know, the movement to end pornography and patriarchy, and actually to rely on mass political resistance, where people are standing up, confronting these different institutions of hatred against women, transforming themselves in the process, and challenging people broadly throughout society to get out of that way of looking at women and be part of fighting for women's liberation.
Sansara, hi, this is Peter Phillips. You're saying that Stop Patriarchy is really looking at patriarchy in terms of controlling women, objectifying them through sex, pushing the baby machine idea on women, and that is continuing in our culture. Of course, the rapes that have been going on in the military, which are quite extensive, mm-hmm. and high numbers of women have experienced that. You've been covering this, and you were at a conference at Hampshire College in April called Civil Liberties and Public Policy, and you had a table there. Tell us what happened at that conference.
I would love to. Hi, Peter. Yeah, we went, about 8 of us went up to a conference. It's an annual conference focused on reproductive rights and social justice at Hampshire College. And 8 of us with Stop Patriarchy went up there, and we had an officially registered table. And we had been participating in the different workshops in the conference, many things, but we were also tabling, and people were coming to our table and getting our literature, talking to us, and we were talking about what this movement is about. And most people were loving it. A lot of people were wearing our stickers throughout the whole conference. But one group of people came over to us, and they were very upset. They came with our call to action, our mission statement, in their hands, and they came to argue because they were very upset that we could that we were opposed to pornography and the sex industry. And they said, you know, who are you to oppose this? And they, you know, I like porn. I'm into porn. One of them was saying, you know, I was a sex worker, so who, you can't tell me that I was wrong. And we got into an argument and said, look, you know, you don't get the right. It doesn't surprise us, first of all, in a world that is characterized by gross forms of domination and degradation of oppressor and oppressed. You know, the U.S. trying to dominate the world, men dominating women, white supremacy and oppression of you know, black people and other oppressed nationality people and people of color. In a world that is marked by such profound antagonisms where everything is use somebody and get over on somebody else, it doesn't surprise us that that gets mirrored and reflected back into people's sexual lives. It would be weird if it didn't. You know, it'd be weird if you lived in a world where everybody is using everybody else, and then in the bedroom, everybody's acting with total mutual respect and equality. That'd be odd. So it doesn't surprise us that people will come to us and say, well, I like porn. I'm turned on by getting off on, you know, watching somebody else be dehumanized. That doesn't surprise us, and we're not here to tell everybody, look, you can't watch this, you can't look at that. We are here to say, and we had this argument with people, you have to, sexuality is not formed in a vacuum. What are the influences that give rise to people being turned on by, you know, this kind of degradation that you see in porn, rape porn, gang rape porn, other things that are very mainstream in pornography that I cannot say on the radio, all kinds of degradation.
What happened there at the conference?
That's right. I'm getting so into the argument that we had. So anyway, we had this argument. People, they disagreed. They walked away.
It's a good place to have the argument, right? That's what you're there for, to debate, discuss.
Exactly. So they laughed. They didn't like what we had to say. You know, that was fine. But the next thing we know, a few minutes later, Mia Sullivan, who is the director of Hampshire College's Civil Liberties and Public Policy Program, the sponsors of this conference, she comes to our table with Hampshire Police, which are actual state police. They are not just New Hampshire security officers. They are police who are stationed at Hampshire College. And they tell us that we have to leave the conference immediately, pack up our table, pack up our literature, take all of 8 of us off the conference, off the campus grounds, or we will be arrested and we're not allowed to come back. So they actually followed us. They stayed with us, escorted us, stayed with us in the parking lot in the dark until we finished loading up all of our materials. They took pictures of our license plates, and they, you know, threatened to arrest us. This was how this difference of substance, this opposition to pornography was treated. What Mia Sullivan told us is that one of the people who'd been at our table had come to them and complained to the organizers of the conference and said that the existence of us at our table making our argument against pornography and how this is enslaving to women had made the conference no longer a safe space for them.
Does that seem like censorship to you, Sansara Taylor?
It seems like censorship. It seems like police-backed political suppression. It seems like, you know, doing the work of a highly repressive state. You don't call police. I mean, look, you shouldn't censor us anyhow. You shouldn't suppress. You answer an argument with substance. You shouldn't censor the argument. But on top of that, to call in state police to threaten to arrest and imprison people who are fighters for women's liberation is one of the most shameful things you could possibly do.
So the liberals calling the man on the radicals.
That's right.
So to speak.
You know, I have to add, because this is a conference, they go to great pains to say, oh, it's a safe space for everybody. It's a safe space, safe. It's like every other word is safe space. And I don't think people should go around, you know, violating each other's space and being disrespectful. Some of the spirit of safe space makes sense. But what they did is they called the police.
These people came to your table to engage in discussion, which is what happens at conferences.
That's right. They approached us, and they were free to leave at any time.
And one would imagine that at a civil liberties conference that would welcome various viewpoints.
If they were true to the name, you would expect that.
Well, Sansara Taylor, imagine, what is your thought here? What if there was a right-wing group, or, you know, maybe a Christian group or another religious group there opposing pornography? What do you think may have happened?
You know, I don't know. I really don't.
I mean, what do you think the issue is here? You wrote a piece for our upcoming book about this, and there's another part of the story that I recall
right.
You sharing with me about how, and you mentioned this earlier here in the interview, about how people, when you were first there, you people at the conference seemed very open to you, seemed certainly very interested, particularly young people. seemed very interested in what you had to say. Now, that doesn't mean it's an automatic endorsement. Doesn't mean it's a, you know, they totally agree or not. It just meant that there was a serious interest. People wanted to hear some of the things you had to say. And you were actually invited to speak elsewhere. How did that go?
What happened is, to fill out the story, as you're saying, I think we did. We were organizing for a day of action around abortion rights. We had our stickers, Abortion on Demand Without Apology, that are bright orange, and, you know, lots of people were wearing them. We also have a bright green sticker that says, if you can't imagine sex without porn, you are screwed. Now, that's my paraphrase because it's the radio. And those were being worn by people. So there was definitely a favorable response to us. Not everybody, but we weren't, like, alienating everybody we spoke to. A lot of people were really into what we were saying, and we were listening and engaging with other people. We also went to workshops. And I think one of the things that happened is that, you know, the Civil Liberties Conference, it's an annual affair. It's kind of an institution. And they have a certain approach to their focus on reproductive rights and abortion rights. And a lot of it, you know, we were arguing out in the workshops. We went to one workshop. I won't tell every story, but one of the workshops we went to, there was a lot of talking about how we have a friend in the White House. Obama's our friend, this sort of thing. And I was in that workshop, and I said, look, he's a war criminal. He's assassinating U.S. citizens. He's, you know, keeping Guantanamo open. And even if you talk about abortion, he's, under his presidency, there's been 3 years of record restrictions on abortion. This man has been viciously against Plan B being available over the count. On the shelves for young women. He has fought common ground with Christian fascists. He had Timothy Dolan, the guy who has fought viciously against abortion and birth control, the head of the Catholic bishops, give the convocation at the last Democratic convention. And so, you know, we got into arguments. We can't rely on the Democrats. We have to rely on ourselves and build mass political resistance. There was a lot of debate going on, and I think the organizers, there was quite a few of the organizers of CLIP, the Civil Liberties Program, who really were getting, they wouldn't call on us anymore. They didn't like what we were saying in the workshops. So I think there was a backdrop that, and some of us were very boldly promoting actual revolution. We were sharing quotes from Bob Avakian's book Basics. We were during the lunch periods and stuff like this, talking to people about this. That was also getting interest. So there was a lot of things that we were doing that were outside of the sort of institutional approach and, frankly, relying on the Democrats' approach that seemed to be dominant within the conference. So I think this probably fed into why they can't really kick us out for that. But it fed into why, once you have one single student say, I feel it's unsafe because somebody challenged my ideas when I went up to them, they seized on that as an excuse to throw us out of the conference.
Well, Sarah Taylor, you were invited to speak, or students were inviting you somewhere, and then you were uninvited? Not at the conference, at another...
On Roe versus Wade. On Roe versus Wade, the 40th anniversary, we were in D.C., and we were organizing a whole week of actions there because we have been out on the front lines fighting to build public resistance for abortion rights. And so we were there. We had a bunch of students who were really had come out to the protests, and it was not a ton, a small number. It was freezing. It was the winter. But the ones who were there were so enthusiastic to see us. They had our signs, our stickers. Some of them said, oh, you know, we're holding an event tonight at our campus, and we're having the president, Terry O'Neill, the president of National Organization for Women, is speaking. Why don't you guys come? It'd be great. We'd love to have you there. And we weren't sure if we were going to be able to make it because we were all from out of town and we had a lot of things we were doing. So we got back to where we were staying. And we decided there was three of us who could make it. So we called to get the information of exactly where. And they were excited. They gave it to us. They said, okay, here's where it is. And those people are getting dressed again to go back out in the cold. And they're getting ready. And we get a phone call back from this student. And she says, you know what? I was just talking to the other organizers, and we realized that the event is totally full and there won't be any room for you. So I was like, wait a second, this is very odd. So I'll try to make this story shorter. It became pretty clear that she had gone to the organizers who maybe knew a little bit more of the different trends in this movement, sort of the and and had paid more attention to what was said out at that protest, because Narrow had been at the protest, Narrow was at the protest, we were at the protest, we all spoke. And maybe this student didn't notice the difference in what we were arguing. We were arguing against relying on the Democrats. We were arguing that people have to stand up ourselves and fight this, and through mass political resistance and not seeking common ground. And we had a big polemic against seeking common ground with Christian fascists. And this was very different than what these other organizations were saying. So it seems that, you know, maybe one of the other organizers, maybe somebody with NOW, didn't want us there in the room with the head of NOW. And so we got this call back that said, do not come. And, you know, they made it clear that as we talked to them, it was not really a matter of space.
I'm sorry, it sounds like your position, not just on pornography, but broader positions in terms of capitalism and patriarchy, and that pornography within those systems is exploitive. And you're pretty clear on that. And, of course, your broader agenda from Revolution Newspaper and that is to transform this, to change this. It's revolutionary.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
that, of course, makes some people pretty uncomfortable. And, unfortunately, that manifests itself in a variety of ways, and some of those ways involve censorship.
That's
and
true.
We don't do that here at Project Censored. We cover these issues in a very open way, and we're out of time pretty much for this segment. But
in previous conversations, Sansara, again, the reason we also wanted to really get you on to talk about this is Project Censored, of course, has also experienced various degrees of censorship
yeah.
and so on within the media reform movement and so on. And again, when one is really calling for a radical, meaning back to the root solution of the problems
mm-hmm.
and build grassroots movements from the bottom up, power to the people style, it really shakes the establishment, whether they're liberals or conservatives.
That's right. The one thing I want to ask is for listeners, if you are outraged by this, join us in opposing this. Go to stoppatriarchy.org/opposesuppression. stoppatriarchy.org/opposesuppression and send a letter. Send a message against Hampshire College for what they did. Join us in not letting this be swept under the rug. And thank you guys so much for having me on.
Thanks so much for joining us, Sansara Taylor, stoppatriarchy.org. That about does it for today's show. Thanks for listening to the Project Censored Show here on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. Special thanks to our guest, Dr. Paul Palmer on Getting to Zero Waste, and Sansara Taylor of StopPatriarchy.org. Special thanks to Anthony Fest.